Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me is Coach Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And Nate Pearson, CEO of Trainer Road.
Hello.
And this is where we answer your coaching questions, whatever they might be, coaching and cycling questions. You can submit your questions to us at support@trainerroad.com, and we'll do our best to answer them on the next week's show. And you can also find this podcast on iTunes, on SoundCloud, and soon to be on Stitcher as well. You can just look up Trainer Road or Ask a Cycling Coach. You'll find us right on there. And you can also leave us a review on iTunes, and we'd appreciate that too. Positive reviews, of course, but only if you feel it's so merited. We'll kick things off this week with Kevin's question. Kevin starts off by giving us a compliment, so of course we'll read his question. We always like that. Great podcast. Keep it going. Good to hear. He says, you frequently retweet users that post massive FTP gains. For an example, 20% gain in 6 weeks. That was a retweet that you had on November 22nd, or that we had on November 22nd, a 13% increase in 1 month, and then another one, 30% increase in 12 months. So big gains that people are getting. That's just kind of what happens, right? When you use Trainer Road, big gains. So, but he has a question, and I think it actually works out pretty well. He says, I'd be interested in hearing you all discuss how much of this might be due to genuine physiological adaptation. In other words, like a true gain, as opposed to an athlete that's new to testing and just getting more experience with FTP tests or bouncing back from a long training hiatus. In other words, help us be realistic about the range of gains we might see so we're not shattered when we don't double our FTP in 4 months. Chad, what do you have to say on this one?
Yeah, Kevin, you're actually right on. When we see big gains like that, those are the outliers. And in what respect they're outliers is up to a lot of different variables. A lot of people don't test well the first time. A lot of people are deconditioned to the point where they're going to see rapid gains. And then some people do just get better. They maybe have, they're really responsive to training. It's not common to see gains quite that large. So we certainly you want to see gains, and we're going to address this in a question a little while later, but certainly you want to see steady, consistent gains. But the people who see these massive gains early on are in some sense setting themselves up for disappointment later on, because those gains, whatever they're based on, whatever caused them, are going to dissipate. And when they start that high, they're going to dissipate really rapidly. So ideally, you'll see gains probably more in the lines of, you know, 3, 5, maybe 7% over, you know, lengths of time, like 3, 6, 9 months.
And it's kind of a good analogy is weightlifting, where someone who's brand new to weightlifting, they can only bench the bar or something. I know when I started in high school, that's all I could bench. And then they get this huge, you know, 40, 50 watt increase in their bench press very quickly. And it could be, you know, 60, 70%. But I think it's almost more impressive for a guy who's at, you know, 4 to 5 watts per kilo, and it gets to like 4.5 to 4.6. To me, that's a bigger improvement, because the marginal gains at that level are harder to do. So don't feel bad. Like, it's all relative. Beginners get big gains in whatever you do in life. Even if you learn to, I don't know, play an instrument or something, you know, after you get over a little hump, you're going to get better faster. But then as you get better and better at it, everything's going to get harder. And that's just how life is.
Yeah, not to say, Kevin, that you're at your physiological peak or limit or anything else like that, but I mean, even for some athletes, some professional athletes, they're hoping for a 1% gain. They're hoping for, you know, maintaining their performance while they're just going for something else.
Yeah, 2%.
Like Nate said, it's all relative. So
2% gain for the top tour contenders wins the Tour de France, right? Like, yeah. you get 2% gain and you won. You win. So it's all relative. Yeah,
for an example, I'm looking for a 4% gain in FTP this year for myself. And if I can get a 4% gain, at least if seeing things is if they progress like they did last year, I should actually get a national championship if that happens, right? That's, of course, a very simplified way of looking at things. But it just shows you, whereas 2 years ago I had like a 25% gain, now I'm okay with just a 4% gain this year. If I can get that, that'll be tough.
And that's so over an entire year, right? Not just a six-week testing period. You're gaining for 4% for the entire year because you've trained so much and you're at such a high level.
Exactly right. Yep, exactly. For the amount of time I can dedicate to training and resting, it's going to be tough to get that. So, And he leads into asking another question that's kind of related to this, Chad, where he asks, is it expected to increase in every training block, regardless of whether it's base, build, or specialty? Should you expect a decline in FTP after an end-of-season break? He has a few questions on that. So let's first start off, where would you see traditionally, all things being relatively the same, would you see more gains in a specific training phase than another?
Typically, the biggest gains are realized during the build phase. So that's when we start heaping on the more specific type of stress and basically trying to find out not exactly your breaking point, but we want to push you harder and harder each week and see probably the most measurable gains on a weekly basis. That's not to say you won't see gains in the other phases. You absolutely will and should. The single exception in terms of FTP improvement might be a traditional base approach where you're focused almost entirely on the really low intensity, highly aerobic work. In that case, the metric you use there would be, you know, heart rate relative to perceived exertion, maybe relative to power. But you're not going to see necessarily big improvements in FTP unless you came into it pretty deconditioned and that sort of stress is new and unusual to you.
Paul, I've used trainer, and this ties in actually to a question that we got from Alicia. So we'll kind of wrap both of them up into one, so to speak. Paul says, I've used Trainer Road to supplement my triathlon training for a couple years, but want to adopt a structured training approach for 2016. I have reviewed the training or the plans and intend to do sweet spot base, sustained power build, and then your specialty triathlon plan. So one of those. However, how should I add run and swim workouts to the plans, and how should I plan the intensity of these sessions using a heart rate monitor?
Pretty simply, use one of our triathlon base or build plans. The triathlon base plans are just about ready. I'm very, very close. And the triathlon build plans will follow closely thereafter. And then I'll actually revisit each of the existing triathlon specialty plans and integrate swim and run workouts into those as well. So basically, we're going to cover that for you. The swim and run workouts are RPE based or perceived exertion based. But that's not to say you can't tie a heart rate or some other metric to your perceived exertion for those workouts.
So everyone knows, too, those descriptions are going to be in the weekly descriptions of the plan. And I'm literally right now looking at these plans in our staging server. Chad's work is already done. There's just some development work. So hopefully by the time you hear this podcast, you can check our site and they'll be up. So we're recording this on a Friday. It could be out Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but we're going to get out. It's a top priority of the company to get these training plans out as soon as possible.
And then Alicia has a question that somewhat ties into that. We're talking about triathlon training again. She says her 2A races are 8 and 9 months away. Joe Friel and others are saying that athletes over 50, especially if they already have a good base, need to do some intensity, even in the off season, in order to maintain or gain speed and strength on the bike. I was thinking about starting your traditional base training plan, and you said low volume, so you have time to swim, run, and do strength training, but soon enough, we're going to have our base plan for you, so you'll be able to look at those, and it'll be specific to what you're doing. But what is your feeling about needing to do some aerobic threshold or VO2 intervals in the off season, for example, every 7 to 9 days? Chad, what do you think?
I'm all for it, and our plans are pretty representative of that fact. You'll see VO2 max work woven into pretty much every plan that's out there, save for maybe traditional base. It's not the hardest thing to build that sort of fitness, but it is such a maintainable thing, and you don't have to dedicate very much time and energy to doing so. Not to mention, as we age, you know, you push 35, 40, 45, 50 years of age, the decrease in VO2 max and resting or maximum heart rate and all that, you can mitigate that decline a bit, and you do it with just little bits of hard effort here and there.
And two, I would suggest instead of using traditional base that you use our triathlon base plans as they're going to be out hopefully by the time this podcast is out.
Yeah, they're much more well-rounded plans and you'll see more measurable gains much more quickly.
And Alicia, you say that you're going to be prepping your goal for the year is 70.3 worlds and we will have a half distance specific base plan and eventually a build plan right for that that will take everything into account. So it'll be a much better route for you. Simon, is it possible to adapt a triathlon program to a duathlon program? Chad, you are a duathlete.
Yeah, there's really not much work to it. Just pull the swim workouts out. The structure's there. If you find that, you know, maybe where that swim workout fell, that you have an extra day and you're recovered and you want to do something, it's up to you what you address. Obviously, my recommendation would be to target whatever limits you. If you're not the strongest bike rider, then there's an extra day to devote to training on the bike. Not the strongest runner, there's an extra day to work on running.
Marco and Todd have questions about form sprints. Marco says, I don't know if I'm doing them correctly, so it's time to reevaluate what I am doing. Form sprints should be used with light power. I'm using, and this is what he's saying, I'm using my 34 and then 13 to 12 on my trainer. And you've got a Tax Mag trainer set at level 4. And I'm not sure if that's going to be closer to being hard or more easy, regardless. And achieving around 167 RPMs for 10 seconds. That's fast, 160 to 170 RPMs. I researched and found that effective sprint cadence is around 120 RPM. Should I then try to train with that low number, or is it okay the way I'm doing it, hitting those really high cadences without destroying my bike and trainer, of course? And of course, he also mentions, I'm not thinking that I should try to sprint in an actual race at 170 RPM. So should he be pedaling as fast as he possibly can, Chad, or should he just be pushing for relatively high cadence?
No, in this case, the form sprints are all about developing leg speed and learning to control leg speed. So right now we're keeping the resistance low, and this is the first of three steps in your progression toward improving your sprint. The first of which is all about speed. So with the form sprints, we, like I said before, we want to keep the resistance low, easy gear, low wattage, and spin as fast as you can control for just a few seconds at a time. These eventually evolve into strength sprints, where we start focusing more on generating a lot of force, putting a lot of, you know, maybe using a really low cadence and really stomping on the pedals. And then we kind of marry the two. And that's when you're going to start to see your 120, 130 RPM sprints, but you're going to do it at much, much higher wattages.
Yeah, I'm impressed with Marco, 160 to 170 RPM.
Yeah, that's
fast.
Not bad.
It's like one of those videos where you see the track guys online and they just like their legs are a blur.
Those guys spin excess of 200 RPM. It's quite impressive.
That's amazing stuff. Good job, Marco. I'm not there. And then Todd asked for a specific workout for form sprints. Can you guys think of any right now?
Form sprints are woven into a lot of the long, slow distance rides, and they're sort of just a way to break up the monotony of a slow aerobic endurance ride. So there, if you search in the workout library for form sprints, you'll see a whole smattering of workouts. The only one that springs to mind that actually walks you through form sprints and has a certain segment, I think she's more than half the workout dedicated to form sprints, is Goddard.
Nice. Yeah. And I can definitely, if you want to look for one outside of Goddard, if you look at the tradition, like Chad said, the traditional base plan, or even early on in the sweet spot base plan, there's a number of those workouts. So, Andre, phenomenal work on the software, with the podcast. So I assume you're talking about the software and the podcast. Good stuff. I've spent hours listening to you. Really great tips. Cool. I'm new to Trainer Road, started cycling 2 years ago, and I really got the bug. I'm 40 years old and have been training this year initially as just being self-coached. And I am now training with the aim of doing an 8-person race across America attempt in 2017. Good luck with that. That's impressive stuff. I've been able to put in 12 to 15 hours of training per week. So more or less, so Andre has a number of different questions here, but the first one really has to do with reverse periodization. So we'll explain that a little bit here, but he's asking, could I do some type of reverse periodization now with more intense buildup type sessions and then start high volume, low base in late January or early February? So in other words, Chad, this is an endurance athlete looking for longer or being able to perform for extended periods of time. What are your thoughts on reverse periodization in this case?
Yeah, so he actually, some more information on that. He says he's in Canada and he has a really hard time staying on the trainer for more than 90 to 120 minutes. So I think that's what's motivating his idea or his push toward reverse periodization here. And my suggestion is not to worry so much about accumulation. You can still get a lot of fitness improvement in those 90 to 120 minutes, especially if they're interval workouts, in which case they're more like 60 to 90 minutes. So I don't know that you need to change things around so drastically. Those longer rides can start to be folded into your training mix as the weather improves. Until then, if you just focus on something like sweet spot base, where you don't have to put a lot of time in on the bike to see big improvements. And then as the weather improves and as you move closer to your event, you start logging longer weekend rides or outdoor rides. I don't think you'll have anything to worry about.
And two, on this, I wouldn't think of it as reverse periodization. It's more of like the principle of specificity is you're going to go sweet spot based build, and then you're going to go into whatever my specific event is. So if you plan on doing, I'm not sure on the, when you do a RAM for an 8-person team, how long each ride is. I think we actually looked it up because we, a dream of mine was a train road RAM win. But I want to say they're 2 to 4 hours per ride. So really not a century driven, but you know, something, I don't know, maybe like a century plan or a time trial plan or something like that. I don't know. Chad, what specialty plan would you have them do? Probably century?
In that case, probably the century plan. Even 40K TT would work to a large extent as long as he's incorporating long endurance rides as well.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what I would recommend is the 40K TT plan mixed in with some endurance because it looks like more or less that's going to be your opportunity there, Andre, to have those longer rides eventually once the weather clears up a bit.
And what he says too in there is that he actually added some and said that he wants to do one specialization of the 40K TT and then transition to one specialization of the Century plan. That sounds pretty awesome to me if he can take the stress.
Yeah, I don't think that would. I think that would actually work quite well. And then in between those two plans, maybe just take a couple weeks, 3 weeks if you have it, and just go back to some lighter, less intense. Maybe just for a couple weeks, do an endurance block. Spend some time outside, accumulating long miles, familiarizing yourself with what it's like to be in the saddle for 3 and 4 hours, depending on the duration of those 8-man bike legs, and get accustomed to the more specific nature of what you're going to be facing.
And Andre's also got a question about weight training. He says that he wants to do more. I know you've discussed this before on the podcast, but my question relates to how to schedule the weights around the rides. So if I'm doing a low volume training plan with 3 to 4 rides a week, should I weight train on the off days? If I'm doing a high volume with 6 rides per week, would you recommend weight training on the tough days or easy days?
Typically, in the case of weight training, I try to, really in the case of anything, I try to keep the stress consolidated so that the recovery is unhampered. So if you have it in you after a hard work to do your weight training, I'd recommend doing it then. There is some science that points to separating it. So do your hard bike training at the early part of the day and then do your strength training. So your endurance training always precedes the strength training. And the strength training, if possible, happens 10, 12 hours later. But it does still happen on the same day such that when you recover, you actually recover. Otherwise, you just perpetuate this stress cycle that never really sees ample recovery and you never really realize the gains that you're working so hard toward.
And I know that we've mentioned this in depth before, but it just bears mentioning once again that with weight training, that you work your way into it gradually, that you don't just go as hard as you can and go do a hard day at the gym because that'll definitely have an adverse effect on things.
Yeah, it's got to be periodized like anything else. There has to be a preparatory phase and then a phase where you work harder and then a phase where it gets specific or just becomes maintenance, depending on your approach.
And in general, we're not big advocates of weight training for extreme cycling performance. If you're an older athlete, that is, you're in your 60s and you don't want to lose a lot of muscle mass because that could hamper you when you get into your 70s, 80s. That's one thing. I personally do some lightweight training just because, so I'm naturally, what they call it, ectomorph, really skinny. In race season, if I don't lift weights, I'll be 6'6", like 179. So my wife says I'm disgusting and stuff. So I will, I'm starting to do a little bit more weight training to put a little bit of mass on and then the low body fat and a little bit of mass with low body fat and you look good. Right now I have high body fat and low mass, so that doesn't look good, but we'll work on that come race season.
Yeah, basically my stance on weight training is consistently that weight training builds a strong body. It doesn't necessarily build a strong cyclist.
Mm-hmm. And another question from Andre. I'm not a triathlete, but I'd like to know if there are additional benefits to adding 2 days of running while I'm training for the ride. So are there benefits to just a cyclist to running, Chad?
In the sense that cross training can mix things up a bit and that running is load bearing and can help with bone density issues. And just the fact that if you're just doing one thing all the time, your body becomes weaker in other respects. I think running can be nicely woven into it. If you're looking to actually benefit your riding, I don't think there's much merit.
I've never noticed much benefit in my riding by just increasing running or bringing running into my program. Mentally, sometimes it helps if I'm just so if I've been training for a long time on the bike and I just need something that will still give me a workout but doesn't isn't the same thing. It's a decent alternative, but yeah, certainly I'm not sure it will add much. On the next question from Andre, when I'm away on vacations or work, how should I keep the fitness off the bike? Running, plyometrics with HIIT training, weight training, anything else like that? Have any tips, Chad?
Any of those will suffice. Any of them kind of lessen the blow. If you're trying to maintain aerobic improvements or aerobic adaptation, then something like running or, you know, high intensity weight training, something that gets your respiration up, your heart rate up, and kind of mimics the demands of aerobic work would certainly diminish any decline in fitness.
And two, this is more of a mental question. So if I'm on vacation, it depends where I'm on vacation. If I'm on, let's say I'm in Maui, right? And I would do long runs on the beach because that sounds like really fun. But if I'm somewhere like, I don't know, Arizona or just someplace that's more of like a concrete city, LA, I would probably do VO2 max intervals and just kind of run back and forth because I don't really want to run through the streets of LA or through Phoenix and do something that's more structured. That's really fun. I hope I get this point across. It's where maybe VO2 max on vacation would probably be the best time spent. But if I'm in Maui, let's enjoy it. Or you're in someplace really beautiful. Or like too, if you go maybe to Alaska, a run through the trails in Alaska, Oregon, Seattle. There's a bunch of great places that you could do that and just enjoy it. Like, it's okay to enjoy your working out. It doesn't always have to be 100% as effective as possible. You save that time for trainer road.
Exactly. Yeah, there you go. And really, like, look at your vacations as an opportunity to mentally recharge yourself and boost that side of things. It really can help. So, and the final question from Andre, he's asking, how do you handle nutrition in the context of base training? And here's what he says. I like to go on shorter rides on a fasting state, but I'm not sure how to do it for base, especially after the initial 90 minutes. Should I have some carb-based nutrition while riding base? I assume he's just meaning lower intensity. Or is the goal to maximize fat as a source? Is it okay to not eat before a three-hour base ride? Chad, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, there are benefits to riding fasted. The limitation is that you're not going to be able to work that hard. But when it comes to base training, you don't have to work that hard. So you can get away with surprisingly little nutrition, even on very long rides, assuming you're keeping the intensity quite low, you know, 70, maybe 75%, but probably more like 60, 65% of threshold. Either way, it's kind of breathe through your nose intensity. And you can do that for quite a long time on little, even no nutrition. And then there are other physiological benefits that happen when you ride in a fasted state. Glycogen depletion is already present, different things occur. So there are upsides to it. But you can pretty much only get away with that, not just during base training, but base rides, whatever time of year they fall.
You know, I've found that when I do this, I've done it just a few times, and I found that my recovery is so much longer. And it might be because I'm going too hard. But have you guys experienced at all that when you ride fasted, it takes more out of you, and your recovery just, like, I kind of felt almost sick the next day. Maybe I just did get sick. I don't know.
I think I have in certain cases, but that's when I push those base rides a little too long. And I recognize it. I'm so far outside of town and I'm already feeling pretty bad, but I don't have any food and I don't want to stop to get any. And I have another hour's riding ahead of me. In those cases, I feel horrible for the rest of the day. I don't bounce back very quickly. But I also know what I'm getting myself into. So if I were to limit those rides to closer to 3 hours in this case, I actually bounce back pretty quickly from them.
Andre mentioned that 90 minute mark, and that's like the magic thing for me. For better or for worse, I do this really throughout. When I'm doing my long rides on the weekends as I'm going through my build phase and everything else, I most cases follow this 60 to 90 minutes where I won't eat. I get up early, I ride, and for the first 60 or 90 minutes, I don't take anything in, and then I'll start eating afterwards. And I've noticed benefits from that for a long time. I have noticed what you said, Nate, if I go past that 90 minutes, if I go 2 hours without eating on the bike and I'm going out for a longer ride like that, then yeah, it's pretty tough to recover. But as long that 90 minute mark seems to do well for me, so...
Yeah, I think I went too hard, and I don't do it very often. I'm opposite. So Jonathan Chad are much faster than me. I'm a, you know, a triathlete, and I was a little bit faster when I was younger, but now I have kids and a full-time job, and I'm not going to be as fast, and I understand that, until my kids get a little older, because I want to hang out with them after work. But when I go and ride, like, one of my favorite things is to stop, and I get like a large cherry Coke, and I get these like these Hostess donuts that have like coconut on them, like coconut crumb. They're like 1,000 calories in a package. Yeah. And I'll eat the whole package. Like, I'll eat the whole package, drink some Coke, put it in my bottle and go, and I'll just be happy as a clam. Like, yeah. I'll feel amazing. And
and you're burning no fat.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's not optimal, but it's still enjoyable, and I can still race and beat some people.
There you go. Austin, first of all, you guys rock. Love the podcast, and I promise you guys, we aren't like writing this in. These are words that these people are saying.
This is real.
Yeah. First of all, you guys rock. I love the podcast, and I have a love-hate relationship with intervals. Keep it up. I've been racing and training on the bike for around 2 years now, and I'm hooked. I'm a type A, all-or-nothing personality, so Trainer Road is perfect. My question is two parts revolving around weightlifting, so more weightlifting questions. I come from a sport where weightlifting is key. We build our foundation during the winter, which includes tons of lifting, grilled chicken, and brown rice, and you call that clean bulking. During my base and build phase, I want to make sure my body is adapting to the intensity and gaining muscle where it needs to in my legs during my riding and cycling-specific lifting. Should I focus on packing muscle by upping my calorie intake with the goal of shedding weight a month or two before my A or B races? Ugh, this one's, what do you say, Chad?
I honestly don't have much to contribute on this.
I do. It's it's an aerobic sport. It's the limiter when you're racing is in riding is not, unless you're a track guy or all you're going to do is sprint, is not your muscles and your legs. It's actually your aerobic system.
And the efficiency of your muscles, right? Like, it's not just the
And look at the Tour de France, Chris Froome. That dude is super skinny. Like, all the best riders, they don't have these big, thick legs. Some guys do in the middle of the pack, and then some guys do that are sprinters. But in general, you don't need to, like, try to pack on the muscle. That will come naturally. Your limiter is going to be your aerobic system, and your VO2 max and your aerobic system put together. Maybe some anaerobic racing if that's the kind of thing, but that's the main limiter for everybody, and that's what FTP correlates a lot to.
Austin, I'm getting a better sense of this question now. I didn't quite understand it at first, but it's hard not to want the extra muscle mass, but what it actually contributes to your performance, it might not match up with what you think. It's really about muscle health, if I could use that term, more than anything. So this is more a metabolic response rather than a muscular one. So big muscles aren't necessarily fast ones, and small muscles aren't necessarily slow ones. I've had my butt handed to me by some very skinny guys over the years. So muscle mass, pretty much for any cyclist outside of track sprinters, is not a high priority.
Next question is from Stuart. You mentioned that you've signed up for an iron distance triathlon here in the UK in July 2016. I plan on using Trainer Road twice a week for quality focused sessions, as well as my usual commute to work. That's good news. I have started on a sweet spot based program, and I intend to follow this with another sweet spot based program, a build, and then going into a specialty plan. So my long ride day, typically Friday, will need to be altered to fit in with my family life. My wife is training for her first half Ironman, and so I'll be riding with her for 2 to 3 hours. My plan is to add a 1.5 hour Trainer Road ride onto either the start or the end of this ride to make up the time or distance I need for my long ride. My question is, what type of workout should I choose to get the best quality in this 1.5 hour session before or after an easy 2 to 3 hour-ish ride with my wife?
First off, if at all possible, I'd reverse the order of that. It'd be better if you could get your quality in beforehand while your muscles are fresh and you can actually hit the target watts, and then follow that with the longer, slower stuff. And going into that ride a little cooked might actually preserve your marriage, in the sense that you'll ride with your wife rather than away from her.
That's a good point.
If you can flip those around, then it's a question of what you're doing, you know, what the workout of the day is, what training phase you're in. But something like VO2 max, even threshold or sweet spot intervals, maybe even some anaerobic stuff, depending, could all work well.
So you could just kind of look through maybe some of the plans and look for some 90-minute rides in there and pull it out, depending on what phase he's in, mm-hmm. to supplement.
Exactly.
So Danny's question, I may need your guys' help to understand this one. I looked over it earlier, and I'm not sure I fully understand it, but we'll read through it. I'm an age group triathlete. I participate for fun, although I do push myself hard to do my best. I have limited time to train with two kids, and both myself and wife being full-time professionals. I ride a P3 with power to max power meter. Most of my training is on a trainer with longer, more steady rides outdoors. I try to do 3 rides per week as per your trainer road plan, and I love not having to think about what I am doing and just doing as I'm told. I've recently...
That's the key to marriage.
I was just going to say, just training and marriage.
More marital advice.
Good advice, yeah. I have recently purchased a road bike because I'm living in a very hilly area, the North Shore of Vancouver, and I'm considering if I should get a power meter for my road bike. I'm not sure if it's warranted if I'll only use the road bike for the longer rides outdoors. However, if I'm okay to use the road bike for indoor rides as well, and you mentioned that it's more comfortable than your tri bike, then I can see a stronger case for a power meter. So he mentions the fact that his goal events for 2016 are a half Ironman and a slightly longer than a half Ironman triathlon. Whereas last year you focused on Olympic distance work. So his first question, should I keep using only his tri bike on the trainer? We've answered questions similarly to this. If you can use the bike that you'll race on the trainer, you'll generally, that's a safe bet that you're going to be building the type of fitness that you'll need on race day, at least in that position. Right, Chad?
Yeah. When at all possible, you use the bike. I mean, if you're exclusively a triathlete, you're not dabbling in road racing and also triathlon, then spend as much time as possible, all your time if possible, on your TT bike, your tri bike.
I understand the comfort thing, though, is I think Jordan Rapp kind of, he's a top-level triathlete. He had some good advice. He said if he's doing something where he's going to have putting a lot of power out, so when you put a lot of power out, you're actually kind of lifting your body up and your saddle's not going to hurt as much. If he's doing a workout like that, he's going to be on his TT bike. When he's doing a longer ride, that's more like kind of like the base phase of traditional stuff, and he's not even at race intensity, then he's going to use his road bike because he's going to be more comfortable and he's actually going to be able to, you know, it's easier mentally and it's just kind of fun to switch it up. So what I've done too sometimes is I'll do like the 2 interval rides on the week. One day, one of them will be TT bike, one will be road bike, and then kind of the longer, if we have like a build phase where there's maybe 3 long intervals on a 90-minute workout, I'll have those all be on my TT bike. And during the work periods, I'll be all in aero bars, and then I'll kind of rest as I'm in the rest periods and get on the bullhorns.
But as far as acquiring an entirely new bike or power meter for that bike, I'm not sure that even on the longer rides, rather than just being in your aero bars the whole time, and I know TT bikes are shorter, the saddle's usually less comfy, but you can alter your position on that very same bike.
Yeah.
I mean, it's expensive. Like, I know a lot of great triathletes who only have a TT bike, and they just ride it everywhere, and they've ridden it so much that it's super comfortable for them. That's also something that I kind of wish I should work to get to that point where I can just ride my TT bike everywhere, and it just feels wonderful.
Yeah, and in Danny's situation, I mean, he already has his road bike, so more his question is just training inside. And I think the best advice, Nate gave some great anecdotal advice there, and the one thing that I can state just from a principle-based approach is the more time you spend in the position that you'll be racing in when you're training, hopefully you'll be performing more efficiently there on race day.
And if you're going to get, you asked the question, can I get away with not using a power meter on my road bike for the longer outdoor rides? I'm going to say yes, that longer outdoor rides that are just kind of base phase, you're not going to pound it out. Maybe you're riding with a group and it's not nice to have be a TT bike in the middle of a group. Yeah, do that. And it's okay. Like, get your structured quality inside. Do some of your more relaxed base phase stuff outside.
And heart rate's a lot more reliable and useful when it comes to those steady state rides too. So it won't take you long to determine what sort of heart rate range you fall in when you're working in the power range you're shooting for.
So I differ from you guys in this sense, and maybe it's just because I love having the numbers there, but this year I had a power meter. So I was training for mountain biking. It didn't have a power meter on my mountain bike, but I had a power meter on my road bike. And when I would spend, because I do silly long mountain bike rides, they're way too long sometimes. And when I'm out on those rides and I didn't have my power meter, I really did miss it. And even though I would try to use heart rate afterwards to measure it up, I always felt like all of that ride data, I had nothing, no point of measurement with that. Even though I had overall ride time, I had heart rate, everything else, compared to power, it was tough. So yes, you can definitely get away with it. And if there is one type of ride to use without the power meter, like Chad and Nate have said, that's probably the best one to do. But if you can get a power meter, it really does help.
Yeah, and it is a bummer if you're power based training and you're doing your data analysis and you actually want data for those rides. And yeah, that's a definite downside to not having a power meter. But you know, you can always work around.
But it's okay.
That too.
Yes,
it's okay.
Exactly.
So I'm the same personality wise as that. I won't ride my bike without a power meter. I like take my kids out and I have a crappy mountain bike and I have a stroller on behind it. And I like want to see my power as I'm taking them to the park.
Exactly.
But I'm just that kind of guy. And I feel the same part is that I don't have a power meter. I feel like it didn't happen. But if you don't feel that way and you just want to get some longer rides out, I'm going to do a 6-hour ride. It's going to be fun. I'm going to be some buddies. Totally. You don't have to have a power meter and you're not going to hurt yourself. You're probably, you know, just don't race up every hill with your guys.
Yeah. Good advice. And then Danny signs off by saying, thanks very much. He loves listening to the podcast on the way to and from work. And he says, it's very motivating. Good stuff. Grant, my ride shows that my power zones are much higher than my supposedly equivalent heart rate zones. What does this say about my FTP and training? He gives some more information here. Chad, do you want me to read through that information first, or do you already want to jump onto this?
No, I don't think it's necessary. The crux of the matter here is that heart rate doesn't always correlate as tidily with power as we'd like it to. So we may recommend power ranges, but heart rate training and heart rates in general are pretty subjective. So you kind of have to determine based on power where your heart rate falls relative to it. So it doesn't sound like the charts or the recommendations are exactly in line for you. So just kind of a little bit of trial and error, just a little bit of paying attention. See, and you know, when you ride sweet spot, my heart rate falls roughly, you know, here to here. When I nudge it up to threshold work, my threshold heart rate is actually here, et cetera.
And a lot of this can be based on genetics too. So don't feel like you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And two, the amount of blood you pump, it's not just the beats per minute, but it's also how much, it's the stroke volume. So like Chad has a lower heart rate, so he's more of a diesel engine and pumps more blood per beat. But I'm more like a butterfly, although I'm taller and bigger than Chad, because I can get a super high heart rate. But it doesn't mean that one of us has superior physiology than the other. Chad does, but in general, it doesn't mean that one of us has superior physiology. It's just a difference between people and how your body works.
Exactly. I mean, we were reading this morning about Chris Froome's latest, the data they divulged, and he has a threshold that's right around 420, 425. When he's working that hard, he's working at about 138 BPM. That's ridiculously low, especially for that much wattage.
Yeah, and heart rate's relative to everybody. Trevor DeRuze, he's our community manager here at Trainer Road. He's a mountain biker. His max heart rate's like 240 or something insane like that. So, and he's always fluttering around there, 200 and above. So,
and he's a pro mountain biker, yep. And his FTP is like 5.2. He blows everyone in the office out of the water.
Yeah, he's a beast.
So it's not that he's slow. He's way faster than
this. And the one thing, the last point that I would point out here, Grant, is the fact that take into account how you calculated your heart rate zones. Where did you get that? And then also, was it done through like a study and were they actually measuring that? Or was this just done with a 220 minus your age type of a deal or with... That's always tough. I see a lot of different calculations for heart rate zones. If I trust my Garmin, they're totally different than if I were to trust any type of calculator online. So that's a tough thing. Power is always a little more reliable in that sense. So Matt, I noticed in the specialty plans I've looked at, the triathlon and Olympic cross-country mountain bike plans, that you don't include any testing in those specialty plans. Should I still be testing on my own or keeping my zones the same for these blocks? He's talking about his power zones.
Yeah, so by the time you've reached your specialty plans, a lot of people have a sense of where their FTP is, and maybe they manually adjust it. That's not to say you can't benefit from testing, though, and the tests are still in there. If you read the descriptions below the week with on the plans page, there are little weekly descriptions, and you'll see the workout of the week or your Tuesday workout is this, if, however, you feel you need to reassess, do an assessment today instead. So all of them include, you know, every 4 or occasionally every 6 weeks, an assessment opportunity, if not an actual scheduled assessment.
Rob, I have a 167-kilometer ride with 8,500 feet of climbing in 5 months' time. Except a couple of 50-kilometer rides in the past couple of weeks, I have done little training for a few months. Looks like I don't have enough time to follow a full base, build, and specialty training plan, which would be 28 weeks. So where would you advise I, and he puts this in quotes, cut some corners? Also, which specialty would you recommend for the upcoming event? So where to trim his training plan down, Chad?
It first depends on what sort of fitness you're coming in with. So if you have no base fitness, then clearly you're not going to trim it there. You'd probably simply do your base and your build and then get as far into a specialty plan as you can. If, however, you're bringing a bunch of base fitness to the table, then maybe you trim your base or maybe even skip your base and dive right into your build training and then into specialty. With 20 weeks, you've got enough time to touch a little bit on everything. So based on that, you're going to do all 8 weeks of your build where those sacrifice weeks come, either during your specialty or during your base training, is up to you and your conditioning.
What about what kind of plan do you think you should do?
In that case, maybe the climbing road race. Is this a road race? Or is it?
No, it depends on how long the... it sounds like kind of like the death ride.
Yeah,
so
it sounds like
I
a road
depends
race.
On oh, okay. How long yeah.
So perhaps Century plan, perhaps 40K TT plan. And even the 40K TT plan, it's called a time trial plan, but really it cultivates sustainable power. So it's a good fit for a lot of different types of events.
I would recommend the Century plan if it's a rolling type of race, if it isn't one with big, long, sustained climbs. Nate mentioned one called the Death Ride, and that's the Tour of the California Alps, and that has very sustained long climbs. You'll be spending upwards of 40 minutes on each climb, and there'll be five, and there are five climbs in the day, right? And other than that, it's pretty much flat or downhill between the two. If you're going to be in a situation like that, the 40K TT plan will really help on building that type of power that'll help you get up those sustained climbs.
Another thing to think about too is if your power to weight ratio is low right now, buy some gears, because if there are long climbs, yes, you could get into a whirl, like a hole, where you're just, you know, the first climb's 80, the next climb's 70, the next climb's 60. You have two climbs left, and you know you got to. I've been there. You got to be in 50 or 40 RPMs, and the day is just horrible.
You'll question if you even trained. It's terrible.
Yeah, exactly. It's better just to do them all at 90, you know, and spin slowly up the hill and make it.
I did that my first time on that Tour of the California Alps ride, and I ended up passing out and just lying down next to a stop sign for a long time. I was sad. I think I was crying. I don't remember what my name was at that point. It was bad. So don't be me. Get the right gears. Chris. Is there such thing as too much sweet spot work? So he mentions the fact he kind of does like a custom training plan. So we'll wrap back around to his question after we do this, because I see a lot of athletes actually training this way. So this will be cool to get some insight on it. He says he's an Ironman athlete, and I do a ridiculous amount of sweet spot work, and ridiculous in near terms. The same trainer road ride, Eichhorn, is the one you do. It's a standard 2x20 at 90% over and over again. So that's two 20-minute intervals in the workout. I may throw in some others, but it's rare. I go for 90%, and if I'm feeling good, and if I'm fatigued, I drop it to 2x20 closer to tempo. I'm seeing results, great results in my mind. FTP has climbed from 260 in April to 275 in July to 300 in September. It is now 320. Holy cow, that's good. That's a huge amount of growth. And I've broken through the 4 watts per kilogram barrier. So if I was a radio DJ, I'd hit the clap drop right now. Good job on all that stuff. I basically repeat the 2x20s roughly 3 to 4 times a week and do a long ride on weekends outside. When it starts to feel easy, I raise my FTP by 5 watts. Every 10 to 12 weeks, I test my FTP, and then I just repeat the same thing. And you say that you enjoy sweet spot work, as you can keep up your swim and run workouts without the fatigue that you get from threshold or VO2 work. So, Chad, his question, should I just keep doing what I'm doing because I'm pleased with my workouts, or should I listen to others and mix things up for more better results?
Well, I think there's kind of two issues at work here. And the first is the efficacy of sweet spot training, and can you get away with doing a ton of it? And the consensus is you pretty much can. That's kind of one of the upsides with sweet spot training. The other side of this is kind of an if it ain't broke, don't fix it sort of thing. This is working for you and it's working really well. So I would ride that train till the last stop. And then if you find that at some point you start to feel a little stagnant, or maybe your power starts to plateau, then it's time to mix it up. I do think that a more well-rounded plan, well, it all depends on what you're after. If you're just looking for improvements in FTP and you're going to ride the sort of events we discussed earlier, triple bypass and things of that nature, then just elevating your FTP may be all you really need. So I would just keep on doing what you're doing until it's not working anymore.
Yeah, Andrew Coggan, too, he said once, he didn't have any studies to back this up, but he was experimenting with the idea of, even for a road cyclist, just doing sweet spot base year-round, not taking any breaks, like being extremely consistent. And for someone who's only going to ride like three times a week, just doing that over and over and over again, he was trying to do it as himself, and it all depends. And, you know, you get to 4 watts a kilo, that's really good for a triathlete, but it's also, you still have probably a little bit of ways to go. And this is another reason why we advocate people starting sweet spot base rather than traditional base. If you were, you know, at 5 watts per kilo, I doubt this strategy would really get you to 5.1 or 5.2. That's when we might put you at traditional base high volume and try to get that last eat, that last bit out. Just know that the you're not going to go at the same, you know this too, that you're not going to go at the same rate forever, and it's going to start to taper off. And as that taper happens, then start to look at some other stuff if you found something already, you know, to change it up from what you are doing already. And the other thing is, too, what you're doing is extremely, other people listening to this are like, hey, I'm going to do that 2 or 3 times 20 to 3 to 4 times a week and a long ride on the weekend. That's mentally taxing, man. Mm-hmm. Chris, you are a mental warrior, and if you can do that, more power to you. But I wouldn't just jump into that kind of training. I was kind of actually doing something like that. It lasted for about 6 months, and then I broke down mentally. I call it the man plan. Everyone at Trader Road knows about that. This. Yeah. I did 3 by 15 minutes at threshold and 2 by 20 at threshold. And then if I could do those, I did this crazy VO2 max workout. And if I could do that, I'd raise my FTP by 5 watts. And I just had to like complete the workout. And I would do that 3 times a week with a weekend ride. And it worked for a while, and then I just burnt out.
Yeah, it's a lot of stress. Chad mentioned earlier that the build phase is where you see where you ideally should see the most raise and, you know, the most increase in your FTP. And that's the type of stuff that you'll undergo during a build phase, but it's periodized and it's limited in its duration for a reason, because it can be tough to maintain. So, all right, Lars. Hi there. I've got a question for the coaches and for the upcoming Ask a Cycling Coach podcast. First, I really enjoy listening to the podcast. It makes the long base sessions on the trainer more interesting. Thanks for that. And we're glad that that's the case. Now, my non-typical question, at least you deem it non-typical, you say you're a triathlete working towards an Ironman, and right now I'm in my 3rd week of the traditional base plan, and you're in the low volume version. I'm planning to do the longer 6-week version of these plans. I'm quite lean, 6'2", and you weigh around 143 pounds. That is lean. A smart scale at the gym measured my body fat, which was 5.7%. Have you got any advice on how to make sure that I will not lose any weight during these base sessions? Any ideas on what to eat before, during, after these sessions? Should I take a look at the burnt calories and try to eat at least that amount after the session? So Lars has a totally different problem than the majority of us, right?
Yeah. Lars, so I have a lot of advice on this.
Cool,
so Little Caesars deep dish pizza, donuts. I mean, it's all about a calorie game, right? So it's calories lost versus calories gained. If you eat very clean, eat more of the clean food. You know, if you're eating chicken breast, brown rice, beans, and broccoli, eat more of that. If you can't stomach any more of that, then get in some more high caloric foods. And it's okay to have a little bit of, you know, high density caloric foods if you're losing weight. And just a mental break too, it's good to do. I know somebody here, one of our employees, Brian, he's just a pure weightlifter. He's extremely strict Monday through Friday, and on the weekends he lets it go, and that dude is gigantic and low body fat.
He's huge.
Yeah, he's gonna beat us all up.
Yeah.
But that's my advice is, I mean, so this is what I do, because I'm in the same camp, 6'6", 179. I can't eat enough unless I eat McDonald's all the time. And during my rides, I will drink coffee, drink Gatorade, eat donuts, eat muffins, because those sound really good to me. I know it's super fun, man. And I will do that and still lose some weight. I mean, if I really try to, but see, I was in a position too where I'm not as low a body fat as you. And if you look at those gym scales too, you got to take that all with a grain of salt. You want to when it does it where the electricity goes through you, it's not like a bod pod or something, or you know, fat calipers are more accurate than that. But relative, you know, as things change and your hydration level doesn't change too much, you can kind of point it if you're losing body fat or not. But in general, just don't. You just got to eat a lot of food. It's awesome.
Do you have any tips on this one,
yeah,
Chad?
Yeah, Lars, I'm not sure
you. Totally foreign to me.
I'm not sure you've actually got much more body weight to lose at that low body fat percentage, your height relative to your weight. I don't know that you could lose much more weight. And if you did, it would have to come in the form of muscle. So there's not much fat to get rid of. The muscle loss is going to take place if your protein intake is insufficient. So if you watch your protein and keep it somewhere in that, 0.8 to 1 gram per kilogram of body weight sort of ballpark, I don't think protein is going to be an issue. I just don't see you getting much lighter than you already are. I'm not sure it's grounds for worry.
Well, it can happen though. I mean,
but just to fuel his workouts, he's going to have to eat enough to get through the workouts themselves. I guess. Yeah.
I mean, you could focus on trying to eat the same amount of calories as that you burned. Well, and that should keep you pretty even.
And that's the other easy get is just match your caloric intake with your caloric expenditure. So, I mean, any power-based ride tells you how many kilojoules you burn. Just make sure you're matching that with whatever you're eating.
Ian, hey guys, loving the podcast. Keep it up. Currently working my way through sweet spot based mid volume. I'm about to take 1 month off work as I switch jobs. So I'm thinking of swapping sweet spot base for traditional base. And you were doing the mid volume, and you mentioned that you're looking to go into the high volume. And I assume this is because you're going to have a lot more time available during that month. Anything I should be aware of, or is this a good switch to make, even though it's just for those 4 weeks? So it's kind of like he's almost like getting in like a mini training camp, so to speak, right, Chad?
Yeah, if you're just looking for a bump in volume and you want to do it the aerobic endurance route, that's not a bad way to go. It'll be a departure from the sweet spot base or the sweet spot approach. Give you a little bit of a break from that, such that you're maybe a little more refreshed when you come back to it. So it's an option. I mean, it depends on what you're after. If you're looking to continue to improve your muscle endurance, it's not the best option. It's maybe a couple of those weeks could be devoted to an endurance sort of camp, and then you get back into your sweet spot training. But I'm not entirely sure what it is you're after over this these 4 weeks.
And two, you said anything else I should be aware of? Okay, if you do high volume traditional base, just know it's going to be boring. That much, right? So my advice is, you haven't seen Game of Thrones, sign up for HBO Go. And yeah, Watch all of Game of Thrones. Find whatever kind of series you think you would like and watch that all the way through for those 4 weeks. And then it could be pretty fun. You just kind of binge watch TV and get some really good fitness. That takes a really like kind of mind numbing experience into like a really fun experience.
Yeah, that can definitely help. Next question. Hi, Trainer Rogue. Great podcast. I'm currently training for the Haute Route Triple. I hope I'm saying that right. I don't know. Haute Route. I don't know. A Triple Crown in 2016. It's a 2,500 kilometer, 22,000. That's 20. I hope that's a typo. 22,000 meters. No, I assume right. It's 2,200. And is currently building. And you say you're currently building your FTP at the moment. It's 315. And you say that you are at 4.315 watts per kilogram. How long would it take to bump me up to 5 watts per kilogram? And he, as afterwards, says, I know it's a guess, but based on experience from others, can you share any insight on that?
I can give you a guess and say that I've done something similarly over the course of 6 or 7 months. So, that's one possibility. And there are also a lot of ways you can go about this. You can simply drop some body weight. Get there even quicker. You can do it maybe exclusively by dropping body weight. But as far as chasing a particular watt per kilogram value, it's anybody's guess. Depends on what your fitness is at the moment. Depends on how well you respond, how much training time you can dedicate. Whole lot of variables here.
Do you guys, this is a question for you too. Do you think anyone can get to 5 watts per kilogram? Or do you think some people just naturally, genetically have like a low enough VO2 max where no matter how much they ride, they're never going to get to 5 watts per kilogram?
Yeah, I have a feeling there are, and I can't back this up with any real research or data, but I'm sure there are low responders out there. So there are some people, 5 watts a kilogram is probably out of the question, but I'm guessing.
That's my same thinking. My rule of thumb has always been like anyone can get to 4 watts a kilo with really proper training.
Agreed.
But getting up to 5 is there's a little bit of genetics into it, and it's so much harder to get to. I mean, 4 is hard enough to get to, but getting to 5, ooh.
That puts you into Cat 1, like domestic professional territory, and I have a hard time believing that anybody can become a Category 1 racer.
Exactly. So don't, I mean, and you could totally have the genetics for that, but don't, if you don't hit that 5 watts per kilo, don't bum yourself out. But sounds like you, I hope you get it. Let us know if you do. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, and also in this case, and this is Morten from Denmark, by the way. Morten, in this case, it looks like actually the 2,500 kilometer, I assume Triple Crown means it's 3 events. So that 22,000 meters at 72,000 feet of climbing, I think that's actually right. Mm-hmm. So if he's going to be going on all of that, since you're doing 2,500 kilometers of racing in there. So
Jonathan, didn't you do something close to this, go to 4 to 5?
Yeah, exactly. And I was just going to share that the biggest benefit with me was weight. And I didn't have a whole lot to lose, but I noticed that when I dropped weight, and I did so in a way that wasn't any type of, you know, binging and purging type of a deal where I was just like trying to starve myself and train really hard. When I did that, I was able to improve my ratio quicker than, I should say, my weight dropped faster than my power raised. But the best way to do this, at least for me, and looking at your situation, it looks like you're going to be doing a lot of climbing, is training that's very similar to what you see on our 40 KTT plan. That type of stuff really does boost your FTP, but you have to make sure that you're periodizing that right, Chad, because it can wear you down pretty quick.
Yeah, it's taxing training. So,
Just to talk about genetics for a second, I believe Jonathan, he might deny it, but has good genetics. Jonathan, can you share with everyone what your first 5K time was? you ran one like last year. You didn't just do any run training. I think you ran like 4 times and you went and ran a 5K.
Yeah, it was 18, just under 19. It was like 18:50 something.
Yeah. So all these triathletes right now are yelling, being like, what? He ran like maybe 20 miles before he even did his first 5K. And then he ran a 19 flat or 18 something, which is, I think that's close to a 6 minute mile or right below a 6 minute mile.
Yeah.
Yeah. We hate you. We hate you.
But for me, to give you an idea, last year, Morten, I went from 4.08 watts per kilogram. And then at my peak, I was at 4.86 last season. So, and it was hard. It was a lot of dedication. And so kudos to you for wanting to go for that. And it may very well be well within your reach. It may be something that's very difficult for you to obtain, but it's something to shoot for just the same. But the one thing I would say is to never really shoot for like the watts per kilogram as much as on that race that you're doing, shoot for a result and make sure you're following your training to get there. Your ratio is going to improve if you're going to do that, you know?
And something else, this kind of relates to one of the first questions we had, is that for Morten, his experience going from 4 to 5 watts per kilogram could be as difficult as some of your experiences going to 3 to 4. I mean, there's life and stuff in it and genetics put into that, but just know that, like, you know, there's a famous quote, it never gets easier, you just go faster.
Yep.
With genetics, you know, the travel of going from 3 to 4 to 4 to 5 could be extremely hard.
Yeah, exactly. So go for it, Morten, and keep us posted on how you do, and especially on that race. I hope that wasn't a typo. That's a massive amount of riding, so... We'll have our last question here. It's by Ingar. Ingar says, I'm currently working on setting up my annual training plan, and I'm planning to take advantage of TrainerRoad's training plans. I'm also familiar with the way Joe Friel suggests to plan the season in the Cyclist Training Bible. That's his book. He suggests a base period of 12 weeks, a build period of 8 weeks, and a peak period of only 2 weeks. The base and build periods fit in nicely with the base and build training plans from TrainerRoad. However, I see no equivalent for that short peak period. The closest thing is probably the specialty plans, but they last much longer, and those are 8 weeks, by the way. They last much longer than the 2 week peaks by Friel. How would you suggest that the last weeks before the first A race of the season are best spent? What do you say, Chad?
I'd spend them tapering. Joe does things differently than we do. It's not to say his way is better than ours or ours is better than his. He just approaches it differently. So we dedicate more time to, in this case, a straight comparison, we do about the same amount of base training, about the same amount of build training. We just spend more time refining your fitness. And when you reach those specialty plans, it's not as though you have to work through the entire specialty plan before you're race fit. But by the time you start it, you've completed your build conditioning, in which case you're ready to race. You're ready to race pretty well too. And then over the next 8 weeks, you just refine that fitness further and further and further. So you can trim that specialty phase to be whatever you want. You can pluck out just those two taper weeks. You can do the earlier four, the latter four. I mean, you can structure it any way you see fit. But the fact is, by the time you reach your specialty phase, you're race ready.
And actually, specialty phases, they have a taper at the end, don't they?
They do. They all have a two-week taper. In most cases, yes.
So if you wanted to compare that to Freel, you could say those last 2 weeks would be your taper, but those other 6 weeks, that's more of the principle of specificity of, I am this kind of racer, so I'm going to practice these types of intervals, where your build is more generic of just raising your FTP. And that's... we believe, and there's science, there's lots of science behind this, is if you want to be really good at anaerobic intervals, practice anaerobic videos. If you really want to be really good at sprints or, the demands of cyclocross, practice like you're going to race. And I think that would be, I don't want to say anything bad, but I think that's a good approach to training.
Yeah, it's as though we bring your fitness to a finer point. So we don't just dump you out of build training, give you a couple weeks taper to refresh you, and then hope for the best. We actually hone your fitness very specifically over each of those specialty plans.
And you also mentioned, Ingar, you say, how would you suggest that the last weeks before the first A race of the season are best spent? So I don't know how many you have planned, but the one thing that Chad said, and I know that I have done, I've actually had two A races that were close in proximity, and I ended up doing the first one earlier on in my specialty phase. And then the second one just coincided with the end of the specialty phase. And I performed very well at both of them. So like Chad said, you don't have to time it so that your A race, or if you're doing multiple A races that are close in proximity, that they land perfectly at the end of that training period. Your fitness is only going to get more refined, and then that taper should help increase your freshness there for race day. But you're more or less ready to race at a very high level. You'll be racing probably long before you even get into your specialty plan. But that's racing at a high performance level at that point once you're into the specialty plan. So, all right, that'll cover it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Once again, you can find this podcast, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, presented by Trainer Road. You can find it on iTunes. Just search for Trainer Road or the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast. You can find us on SoundCloud as well. And soon enough, you'll be able to find us on Stitcher, hopefully this week. So you'll be able to access the podcast that way as well. You can submit your questions to support@trainerroad.com, and we will have them in the queue and get to as many as we can in the next episode. Thanks a lot for joining us, guys. Happy training.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody.